We're going to go ahead and try and get started. Representative Lem asked to go first. He is not here. This is the House Committee on Revenue. Today is the 13th of April. It's as I say, about 1:04, 1:03 in the afternoon. And we'll open first a public hearing on 2964. I've got three state representatives here. Thank you, gentlemen. Please come forward. We're honored to have you here. And don't want to take any more time from your busy schedule than we have to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Representative Chuck Burley from House District 54. And I'll let these other gentlemen introduce themselves. I do have some handouts for you. Thanks, Jim. Mr. Chair, we appreciate the opportunity to have this hearing on House Bill 2964. Under Oregon law, of course, when new growth and development occurs, various taxing districts apply their respective tax rates against the valuation of new development and use that revenue to provide services for those new developments. But unfortunately, this is not the case with school districts. And so, in a sense, school districts are being penalized by the growth. They get the impacts, but no funds to help with their capital needs. There are many bills this session addressing this, including SDCs and impact fees and various other types of things. And this bill is another alternative to be considered in trying to address this issue. What I like about this bill is that it doesn't require any new fees, charges, or taxes. It simply diverts what's known as the exception value from development into a local school district capital fund for 2 years. Then that reverts back to the local revenue fund as it would have ordinarily. I'd like to go through the bill specifics and point out some amendments, if I may, Mr. Chair. Section 2, sub 1, defines what is the exception value. Under Measures 47 and 50, the maximum assessed value for a piece of property is limited to a maximum of 3% growth from year to year. But there are five exceptions to that. One is new property and new improvements to property, or what is perhaps easier called new construction. Two is subdivision or partition. Three is rezoning. Four is omitted property. And five is disqualification from exemption, partial exemption, or special assessment. So if from 1 year to the next any of these five exception conditions exist, the property's maximum assessed value may increase more than 3%, and this is what's referred to as the exception value. Section 2, sub 2, limits the applicability of this bill to just the school district. No other education districts, not community colleges, and nor any of the local government taxing districts. It's just the school district. Section 2, sub 3, compresses the taxes extended on the exception value in accordance with the standard compression practices already found in ORS 310150. Section 2, sub 4, requires the county assessor to report the amount of taxes imposed on the exception value for the school district to the Department of Revenue. And then the next paragraph directs the Department of Revenue to compile the total amount of taxes imposed on the exception value of all school districts and report this to the Department of Education. Now, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd like to point out, starting on page 2, sections 3 through 7 address urban renewal areas, and we do want to strike all of those sections. We don't feel that we want to get involved with urban renewal areas. We think that the way that's written would actually have an adverse impact on the purpose of urban renewal areas where they do exist. So we want to take sections 3 through 7 out.
So starting on line 2 of page 2, forward through line 20 on page 6 is all excluded, including some of your new language.
Actually, Mr. Chair, it would be all the way through line 27, page 8. So it would be sections 3 through 7.
All of 7 as well.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
It would also save a great deal on paper.
Yeah, it certainly would. So So that starts on page 2.
That's correct.
All of page 2 after line 1.
That's correct.
All of pages 3, all of pages 4, all of pages 5, all of pages 6, all of pages 7, and down through line 27 mm-hmm. on page 8, you want omitted.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And then starting on page 7, section 8.
That's an omitted page.
Page 8.
Yes, the original page.
All right.
Page 8, section 8. What that does is it amends ORS 327.013, which is the state school fund distributions.
Yep.
The amendment is found actually on page, if you'll turn a couple pages to page 10, lines 33 to 36, where paragraph 11 is added in. This paragraph says that the local revenue for a school district is not to include the exception value reported to the Department of Education in Section 2.5 earlier. And this is for both the current fiscal year and the next succeeding one. So in other words, what we're doing here is when the exception value is calculated, for 2 years that value is diverted from local revenue to a capital fund, and then in year 3 it goes to the local revenue.
So that would pull the local revenue from the described improvements that you're proposing here out of the state school formula.
That's correct, for okay. that two-year period.
Chairman Buckley.
Yes, Representative Kump.
Representative Buckley, Burley. Sorry.
Good job.
So after... Are you saying that after the 2 years, would it go back into the general fund, or does it stay in a holding pattern?
Chair Butler, Representative Kump, no, you're correct. After the two-year period, it would go back to, because it's not there at first.
Right.
We divert it for 2 years
right.
to a capital fund, after which it goes to the local revenue fund, as it would have
okay.
without this.
Thanks.
Section 10, it's new law that says the exception value collected is dedicated to capital projects, and capital projects are already defined at 280.060.
I like that.
Section 11 establishes an account for each school district, the capital account, if you will. Section 12 makes this bill effective July 1, 2007. This will have to be amended a little bit because we're taking Section 3 through 7 out, and we'd have to work on that. The last one, Section 13, refers this measure to the voters, and we want to delete that whole section. We don't feel now that this needs to be referred to the voters. Now, Mr. Chairman, I had distributed to you a couple of a brief handout, one of which is just a quick workup from the Redmond School District. Looks like this, and it's pretty self-explanatory, but I do want to call your attention to this worksheet. When I first started looking at this bill, I looked at the testimony. This bill had been introduced in a prior session, and I looked at the testimony. I talked to folks from the Department of Revenue. I talked to our county assessor in Deschutes County. One of the problems or concerns that they had was that currently assessors do not capture the exception value. This is not part of their typical process in doing this. And there was some concern about the impact and the cost that would be required to modify their system, so to speak, to be able to capture and track this, particularly on a property-by-property-by-property basis. What you have here is a worksheet that our county assessor provided me last week that shows a couple of options, and I want to refer you directly to the box at the bottom, this portion down here. What you see is the taxes imposed after compression line. Okay, this would be in any given fiscal year after the assessor goes through all of the process as currently prescribed by law. Those are the taxes imposed for the Bend La Pine School District for each of the fiscal year. The next line where it says 3% base is simply the previous year increased by 3%. So, for example, under 0001, you see the $27.4 million. That is simply 1.03 times the prior year's imposed taxes. He then subtracts those two figures for 0001 and comes up with a figure of $1.6 million, roughly. Now, what my assessor is suggesting is that we might want to look at this process. It's a means to capture the same roughly the same amount of money. It's after compression is already done, so this will not have any effect on any individual accounts or properties, but it captures that 3% dollar figure. And you'll see here that based on his estimates in the Ben Lapine School District, we were looking at 1.6 the first year, and then you'll notice how that 1.6 carries to the next year. That goes back to the 2 years. And then after that, the 1.6 would go to the local revenue, but you're picking up then the next, so it's just kind of a rolling number as we're going through this.
Does that calculate back out? Has he gone back, has your assessor gone back and determined that the actual new property is the tax on that is $1.6 million, or is that just the estimate based upon a rolling 3% increase?
It's more the latter, but we believe, and I've spoken with folks from Department of Revenue about this, we believe that most of that would be due to the exception values.
And does your assessor have an ability to capture that easily, that information?
No, and that's why he was suggesting we might want to look at some way to work around, because if we go with the original intent of this bill to actually do that on a property-by-property-by-property basis, the concern is that could be costly to implement that.
No, it'll make them crazy.
So okay. This is, you know, we're looking at some ways to try and make this work. But the other thing that this spreadsheet points out is that in our case, in the Ben Lapine School District, as you can see, once this thing kind of gets into place, we're looking at roughly, you know, $3.3 to $3.8 million a year going into a capital fund for school construction and capital improvements.
Per biennium?
That per fiscal year.
So that's, I see that because that's the 2 years. That's
right.
That's the 2 year amount.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
So that concludes my testimony.
Representative Wisdom, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Chairman Butler and members of the Revenue Committee. I am Representative Gene Wisnet from District 53. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify and ask for your support of House Bill 2964. 2964 will permit school districts to use new local property taxes from new industrial and residential properties for 2 years to help finance capital construction and capital improvement projects. The bill helps all school districts finance new school capital construction and capital improvements, those with rapid growth that need to build new schools, and those with declining enrollment that need funds for capital repairs or to remodel. Representative Burley and I, and some on this committee represent, and Representative Crummell also represent school districts with rapid growth. And some of you have schools with declining enrollment which need repairs. This bill will help us all. It allows the local growth revenue to remain in the school districts for a limited period to help finance these needs. School districts have capital needs, but they are not allowed to capture any increases in property taxes to help with the local needs. In summary, this bill allows school districts to use part of their property tax increases for local capital needs. Mr. Chair, this bill, I spoke to Representative Haas today, and this is different than the bill that was submitted a couple of years ago, and that we've reduced it from 5 years to 2 years. And it also covers commercial property, not just residential. And it also adds capital improvements, so that helps all school districts. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26. As has been stated, I come from two school districts that are very fast-growing. One in particular is and has been and continues to be the fastest-growing school district in the state, with a sustained growth of about 6% as last reported. House Bill 2964 is before you now, and I would appreciate your support. What this bill does has already been alluded to by allowing schools to capture the exception value for a very short period of time to bring about dollars for capital construction. I think one of the things that's really nice about this kind of a mechanism is that it does not raise taxes, but yet provides a significant amount of money for capital construction on a statewide basis for districts across the state. It allows the exception value to go back on the rolls after only 2 years, so that money is then going to be transferred over to the operations side. So what you get is a short period of time where you've got money going in for capital construction out of the same base, but then after a short period of time, 24 months, it's going back over to the operations side. And I think that that's one of the things that groups that might oppose this kind of a bill, because it's taking operations away from school districts. It's for a very limited period of time. And this bill, this kind of mechanism will raise, as you can see from the charts that Representative Burley has provided to you, will raise significantly more money than just about any other mechanism that is available to us or would be available to us without actually raising taxes. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much for hearing this today.
Thank you very much. Questions of these representatives? Representative Berger is recognized.
Thank you. Gentlemen, explain a little bit. I was busy reading all those sections you took out and then didn't get to the end. That was a joke. thank you for the laugh.
Play the soundtrack.
Explain to me the mechanism here. I did catch the part where you took out the vote at the end. So would a district elect to do this on a district-by-district basis? Would this be automatic for all districts around the state? And how would districts then, if a district chose to go for a capital construction bond, this would be in addition to money? Is that the concept here?
I believe the way... Representative Chair Butler and Representative Berger. I believe the way it's written is that yes, it would set this account up for each school district. I don't believe it's written to be optional. I'd have to go back and check that specifically, but it does not preclude any school district's options to go out for a school bond. In fact, one of the things that you could do with the money, the funds that are in this capital fund, is use those for debt service.
Pay off previous bonds.
Right.
Okay. Representative Comp is recognized.
Just for clarification now, I just reread it a little bit too, Representative Burley. Now, when you have your funding sources, you're talking about the funding source for this is coming from property tax. And because schools have different revenue groupings, then it would literally swing from a property tax, which is a local revenue, back into the state general fund, which is a state revenue. I just hope that that's not going to be a problem when you're looking at, you know, moving the funds from one revenue source to another revenue source for a school district if they're not used. That might be, I just want to make sure the statute somewhere is real clean on that perspective. Does that make sense?
Let me see if I
understood the question by giving you this answer. First of all, the state school fund grant, you know, the funds that a school district gets is comprised of the general purpose grant, which comes out of the state school fund here.
Right.
Facility grant, transportation grant, less the local revenue. Okay, so the local revenue is by laws defined as the amount of property taxes actually received by the district.
That's
and all
what
these
I wanted
other
to
kinds
know.
Of things. So if everything else is constant right now and we're collecting in a school district this much and somebody builds a house, okay, so you're collecting this much money. Somebody builds a house and you get this exception value. Well, last year that money wasn't in the local revenue. So what we're doing by this basically is delaying for 2 years when that money is going to hit the local revenue stream. And instead, for that two-year period, it goes to a capital fund.
When you read your description there is all I wanted to know, because it was contained within that, is how those funds stay in that one funding source. So that's what I wanted to know, because if that was separated out in a statute, then I was concerned, but it isn't.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Esquivel?
Yes. Representative Burley and Wisnett and Kimmel. During this interim time that we're taking this money away from the State General Fund on education, who's going to make that up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, we're not taking it away.
Well, you just aren't adding it, but it's a potential revenue loss.
Right, it hasn't hit that stream yet. We're just delaying that for 2 years and putting it into a capital fund.
Okay. Representative, let me just ask this question. I think you previously brought a bill before us relative to the phantom students. On these high growth districts, don't they enjoy a greater number of students in effect using the higher of those two numbers for the next full year in your calculations?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understand your question. High growth areas, yes, are getting their total amount of money, but it's also a lot of the schools. My district is getting less from the state than over half of the school districts because of our local property value, we're actually contributing to other school districts. This is not affected by the phantom student or the declining enrollment situation. And as I said, the thing that we've changed about this bill is we're trying to help everyone that's out there. And this is money. We're not taking this money away from schools. We're delaying putting it into the big pot to be distributed out for 2 years. It's still going for school needs. It's not going for any other purposes or new boats for the builder of construction projects or developments. It is dedicated to school needs. And that's what we're looking at here. And it's not, and also, Mr. Chair, I would add that I'm not aware of Representative Crummell's situation, but both Representative Burley and I are in districts that have passed school construction bonds. We have passed school construction bonds, but it's still more difficult to pass school bonds. And we have the city of Redmond, which I represent, is the fastest growing city in the state of Oregon. And to go back and back to the people and say, build us a new school, this helps us. It's not going to build a schoolhouse. This money will not in Redmond. But it helps those areas go out and get the support for bond issues to build schools. But as I stated, we tried to add again to this bill to help those schools that have declining enrollment, the smaller schools, because you have to go out to your voters to get money to make capital improvements. And this bill provides that source that I think the bill previously did not have in there. It was only for new building, for new construction. So it's, yes, the money does not go into the big school formula for 2 years. How much money that is, we're not sure. We've been given guesstimates of $25 million statewide.
I'm calculating right here. This is from the Bend Lapine. This is 3, 6, 9, 12, 13, 14, 15 million in 5 years just from Bend Lapine.
No, sir. Mr. Chair, it's only 2 years. You only get the last 2 years. That's just showing you how much more that would be. You know, you can only use the third year. You're putting the first year's money back into the school form.
That's in the formula that I'm seeing here. It carries the next year forward. So if I take the amounts from 0001 through 0405, and add up the amounts in that bottom box right there. Over a period of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, that's about $15 million. It isn't?
No, sir.
Oh, okay.
I'm reading
it wrong.
Mr. Chair, maybe I can shed a little light on this. I don't know, or maybe Representative Burley can, but in your first year, your capital fund is going to be $1.6 million. You see that at the bottom.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
The next year, you now have the original 1.6 plus a new growth of 1.7.
So that's another 3.4.
So your cumulative is 3.4 million.
The other went back in.
And now the third year, that 1.6 million has gone back into the general. It's going
so
to
after
everybody.
After the second year, the 1.6 goes back away.
Yes.
But I've still kept
goes
the
to 1.6
twice.
Right.
So kept the 1.6 twice.
Yes.
I keep the 1.789 twice. I keep the 1.74 twice.
Yes.
I keep the 1.56 twice. I keep the 2.67 twice. I've got a problem with my math, but I'm looking at those totals down there.
You know what, Mr. Chair? You must be correct because in the second year of the program, 01-02, for example, you would have collected the 3.4 million
because
of the first year and the second year.
Looks like I've built a school in 5 years.
At the end of the 5 years, you basically bought a school.
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted
to hear. Although an elementary school now costs about, I believe it's in Representative Comp, can correct me if I'm wrong. I think it's about $22
million. Is it?
Okay. And a high school comes in budgeted at about $38 million.
Well, we put on tents in Eastern Oregon. Representative Berger.
Which brings me to another thing that I thought of when you were discussing, and I have great sympathy for these fast-growing districts, and we've heard from Representative Crummell about his Sherwood district, and I having had Salem go through really rapid growth. You have an ear here to some of the problems. One of the things that, even if you get to maybe $12 million in 5 years here doing the math that I just did quicker than and not as accurately as our chair, that doesn't build you very much. And if your needs are greater and you go for a bond, aren't you subject to you have money, we don't need to go for a bond sort of an attitude? You've already got this mechanism. Growth is already paying its way. And this is more of a philosophical question than something that you could just answer within this. But you see what I'm getting at? As somebody who has led two school bond efforts and gone to the public a lot with the message of need for high-growth districts, I'm real sensitive to the messages that you send.
Mm-hmm. I think if I may jump in here, Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, I think that what this does is that it really allows the school district to go out for the bonds because they have a match that is already in place. They can say, look, here's our down payment. I mean, Sherwood 3 years ago, I think, passed about a $75 million bond. Westland-Wilsonville passed about a $100 million bond. Beaverton, I believe, was about a $150 million bond about three or four years ago. Mm-hmm. So the districts that Hillsborough passed a bond in, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago that was about $75 or $100 million. The districts that are in my legislative district and touching my district that are high-growth school districts, the voters are stepping up to the plate to build the schools. But what this will do is help defer some of that, and the key to it is that this is going to be helpful statewide. So you've got the school building in John Day that needs to have a new roof or a new heating, ventilation, air conditioning system put in, or a school in Medford that needs to have some kind of work done on it, or a school over in Perrydale School needs to have repairs done. These districts are gonna have some funds there to do some of the immediate repairs, because one of the things that we're always hearing about from the schools is that so much of their resources, their operational resources, go towards their staffing and their supplies and that sort of thing, that they're not putting any money into their maintenance. And we're getting into deferred maintenance. And as we have learned over the last 15 years, deferred maintenance is all it's doing is delaying the inevitable, and it is the worst decision that a school board can make. They got to figure out a way to suck it up. Well, now we've had so many years of deferred maintenance on so many buildings in the state that I don't think the school districts, I don't think a lot of boards really see any way that they can dig themselves out of it. And they may not be able to dig their way out of it. This gives him a mechanism to at least create a match that then when they do go to their voters for a bond, they can say, look, we have some money put away from this capital fund that we can utilize. It's creating a 10% or 15% or whatever the percent, or 5%, whatever the percent match is. And now will you give us some money to put us over the top so we can do these repairs?
President Crummell, do you have any of the similar figures for the Sherwood area?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't. I don't have. I could certainly try to get some of those figures for Sherwood and also for the Westland-Wilsonville area.
Yeah, my calculation is this is over $15 million, and the startup year, which is a half accumulation plus 4 years, It's in excess of $15 million just for one school district. I'd like to take a look at a high value district as well. Not that Bend Lapine isn't.
Mr. Chair, I will get that for you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I may too, I'd like to follow up on a couple of things. Your math is, I'm sure, quite accurate. I haven't done that, but when you add this up, it's true, that's what you've got accrued and sitting in this fund is $12 to $15 million. But again, I want to point out that this dollar figure at the bottom for each fiscal year is just simply the amount that is not going into the local revenue fund for that year. It's just that dollar amount at the bottom.
Right, which is Representative Esquivel has indicated,
right,
comes eventually out of the state school fund. Eventually it has to be backfilled.
The way that the funding is, that's correct, but it's going to be based, again, on the number of students.
Right.
But the other thing that I wanted to comment on was that though you may have $15 million in the bank, so to speak, which might be half of a school if you look at a $30 million project, I would submit that once you've got something like this set up where you've got, you know, $2 million a year coming in through this, in very rough figures, every $1 million is $10 million worth of borrowing capacity. So if you've got this stream set up, you don't have to go to the voters for a bond. You can go out and go to the debt market, and here's your debt service.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a little bit of a problem with this in that even though you say you're not taking it out of the school operationals, you are taking it out of the classroom, and I have a problem with that. Building schools when we can't even fund what we've got, I have a real problem with. And you say we're just delaying it, but in delaying it, you're keeping it from being used in the classroom, and that bothers me some.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair,
you want to respond to that?
Yeah. Chuck covered most of the details, but again, someone that's worked for a year and a half on the school distribution formula and knows about a lot of problems with the school distribution formula, including what we learned this year in the reserves and what the chair and I have talked and discussed about phantom students, this money is staying for school needs. It's staying for school needs. It's local money generated locally by your tax money, and it's staying in the local area for educational needs. You need a building. You know, when I look at the school distribution formula and it comes out $5,000 per student, that doesn't include any of the bonds or the taxes that people paid to build schools. You need a schoolhouse for the people. You know, remember the little game we played with the church? Is you got kids in the school building. You got to have money for school buildings, and this money stays local. It's local tax money that's kept for school needs.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Can I respond, please? Thank you. One of the things that I would point out is that generally once a district is ready to actually go to construction on a building, there is probably anywhere from an 18 to 24 month window in terms of actually building, you know, from the time they start grading until the building is up and ready to actually open. So in some respects, what you're doing is that we're sort of, well, we are, we're taking part of that operational money that would be there that actually is actually delayed on our, especially on our high growth districts such as Hillsboro and Beaverton and Sherwood, is actually delayed by about a year from the day that the student shows up at the door to when the money actually follows the student there. But what we're doing is that we're delaying that, but we're taking those dollars that can be used for the construction, and then by the time the construction is finished, and now you need the operational dollars to heat the building and staff the building and that sort of thing, those dollars are now shifting over because of the way this is written. Those dollars are shifting over to the operational side from the capital construction side. So I just point that out.
Thank you very much. Representative Hass is recognized.
I just comment, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank these gentlemen for bringing this forward. In Beaverton, that's been averaging 800 new students every year for the last decade, and that's like every single day there are two more kids sitting in a classroom than there were the day before, and that's been happening for 10 years. this state can't deny that this is happening. I mean, whether it's Bend or Sherwood or Beaverton or anywhere else, we have these huge needs. We're building like two schools a year in Beaverton. Hillsboro's fast growing too, and we can't pretend that this isn't happening, that we don't have this growth, and that it's someone else's problems.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Conner.
Not a comment, but also a statement to, and I haven't read the bill real thoroughly, but as a principal.
Don't read the pages 2 through 8.
2 through 8.
I won't. Do that. I won't.
I made a joke about it, but
yeah.
Never mind.
Yeah. But as a principal of a school that's over 50 years old, 3 years ago we had a budget that was $7 million to replace our old steam generated heat, because I can't tell you how many mornings I had teachers call me saying, Betty, my room's cold, you know, and the kids, I mean, whole parts of the school were cold. And that was, like I say, 3 years ago, and we all know what the budgets happened 3 years ago. Well, that $7 million, the superintendent called me in, pretty soon it was down to $3 million. But we ended up only replacing one of the big furnaces, but the biggest thing that we lost in part of that transition was the school is old. It has absolutely no firewalls. There was a small amount of that budget that was going to help make our school safe. We did not have enough money to pour cement into our walls, and if that school gets on fire, we will lose lives. To this day, that haunts me, and those are the decisions that have had to be made in school districts, particularly in our old schools. And I mean, thank you for bringing the bill forward.
Thank you very much. Further questions of the representatives? Thank you. We appreciate your being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Maybe you need to come and fix.
Now we've got other folks signed up on this bill, and we have Representative Ackerman here on another bill. I feel to be conciliatory to our colleague, and so what I'm going to do is temporarily close the hearing on House Bill 2964 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2146. Thank you, Representative Ackerman. I'm sorry, 3146. Thank you, Representative Ackerman. We appreciate you taking your time out of your busy schedule to be with us, and apologize that you've had to wait as long as you have.
That's all right. I appreciate your courtesies in doing that, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Ackerman. I'm a state representative from Legislative District 14, which is essentially north and a part of West Eugene. House Bill 3146, which is before you, has a very defined goal, which is to limit administrative salaries to 7% of actual revenues received by a school district. This bill is built out of several of my experiences at the local level, serving on a local community college board for almost 12 years, and the last four serving in a capacity as chair for three of those 4 years, and going on a basic quest to learn more about or the local budget law and the local budget process, and going on a quest for something which I call the transparent budget. I found that in going through all the budget hearings that I went through at the local level, that they were pro forma, they were not investigatory, they were not revealing, they were just a process by which a pro forma budget could be presented just for the purposes of passing on to the next order of business. I became interested in getting information from the budget so I could sort of trace the money through the process. As I did, I got more resistance than I expected and found more information than I expected. I think also what has motivated me is not only the situations coming out of our large metropolitan areas where we have which I think are exorbitant salaries and exorbitant settlement benefits when administrators leave work for whatever reason. I'm talking about settlements in the six figures. All of this is money, I think, which is jeopardizing our educational side of the budget. So I understand fully the local control issue, and that many people will say this is some intrusion upon local control. I reject that argument, because I think as long as the state of Oregon is making such a substantial investment in the local school districts that we have the right to administer some form of legislative oversight to their operations. And to some extent, local control, if they are not they're not prudent and not forthcoming in their figures, then I believe also they need some oversight. The most recent example of that, of course, is the discovery after 10, 20, 30 years of the ending balances and reserve balances that many of our school districts have held, which have not been disclosed as a part of the budgetary process, but probably only were discovered as a result of investigative journalism. So with those things in mind, I felt it was time to look at some reform and set up a process by which administrative salaries could be curtailed at the school district level, and providing a series of remedies to redress that if they did exceed 7%, and also provide as a part of the local budget law that there be a separate schedule in the budget itself which would name the administrative positions, name the name the levels of compensation as defined in the Act, so we could determine up front, use that as a database to discover further whether the 7% limitation was being exceeded. So that was explains my interest, my motivation, and I think the reasons. My underlying belief is that administrative salaries and benefits are too exorbitant, and I reject any notion that takes those extra funds away from the instructional side of our K-12 budget. So with that, I'll conclude and be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Representative Akron. Let's hear from Representative Comp at the same time, and then we'll open it for questions.
My statement is very brief, and I know Paul will give it to you in a moment. But Chair Butler and members of the committee, thank you for holding this hearing on House Bill 3146. For the record, I am Representative Betty Comp, and I represent House District 22, and I'm here in support of House Bill 3146. 3146 provides what all of our constituents are asking for, and that's fiscal accountability. And that fiscal accountability is for the K-12 educational systems. House Bill 3146 places boundaries on administrative spending. The goal is to clarify where and how much general funds are being spent on administration instead of what is being spent in the classrooms. Educational research for the past 10 to 15 years of school reform models depict percentage scales to ensure high academic achievement in schools. And I'm sorry, this is poorly written. Those percentage scales are written with the fact of how much should be spent on administration, how much should be spent on support services, and how much is spent in the classroom. This bill complies with the research model. This is a beginning step for the communities in our state to ensure the focus is on students rather than administration, and I urge your support and immediate passage of House Bill 3146.
So, representatives, the definition of the administrative services in a school district can be very well defined, and when an administrator uses supplies in one school district, it will be charged to administration. When the administrator uses supplies in another, it will be charged to the same thing and not the classroom.
That's exactly right. There are funding codes, revenue. We have the revenue codes, and then we have expenditure codes, and they're clearly defined.
And so in every district, the accounting is uniform, such that if I were to say here's a supply cost. The supply cost that goes off for administration will always be identified for the administration.
Yes, and the subcomponents of the bill, and I don't have the bill in front of me, but it says the areas of administration for dues, membership, and all that. Each one of those categories has its own state coding.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Questions of the members of the committee for these two good representatives? Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, can you broaden up the definition of 7% here? Is this typical of most states? Why did we pick 7%? And then the second half of my question, I'll ask up front, is where do you think we are now?
I thought 7% was pretty catchy, but I call this the 7% solution, but that, you know, probably doesn't have any background. Representative Comp did the numbers. I did the letters, so I'm going to defer to her.
This goes into the research, and it's not only just national research, but worldwide. One of the countries that's involved in this research is New Zealand, and I mean some really high, top-notch educational systems. And the 7% is part of that total general fund percentage. And the other end of that is if you're spending more than 11% of your total budget on your custodians, administration, other things other than classroom, then you've stepped outside of the norm of what's best for education.
And the question is, where were we at today? What
the question where we're at today, I would say it's different in every district. And some districts are, yeah, some districts are less than 7%. I would say they're probably at about 5%, up to in the fact of 12%.
Follow-up, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Compton, because you threw it out there, was this part of the New Zealand reform package?
Yes.
Great, thanks.
And what is it in New Zealand?
I don't have my book in front of me. I could sure get you those figures.
The Kiwi plan.
Less than 7%?
I don't remember right now, Chairman Butler.
Thank you very much. Further questions, Representative Galizio?
Yeah, I have to admit I'm not familiar with the New Zealand reform package. I feel undereducated. But my question is, I mean, I know I'm speaking for some people in public education. Every time this body, with all its wisdom, tries to do something that, I don't know if I want to say, sort of micromanages, it makes me a little nervous. So would you be comfortable setting a precedent that then it would logically follow, perhaps, that we should limit, let's say, teachers' salaries to a certain percentage, and we should limit professors' salaries at higher ed and instructors at community colleges. Would you be comfortable with that, setting that kind of a precedent?
No, frankly, I'm not. I think that's a part of the collective bargaining process, which I think is has its own checks and balances and its own dimensions, and I prefer to leave that in that area. I'm looking at areas here where if we believe that 7% is an average or a norm, I'm wondering how we achieve accountability if the administrative salaries and compensation exceed that. So I'm willing to say this is an accountability bill. It's not a bill that takes us down a slippery slope.
Follow-up, Representative? Okay, Representative Hass.
Thank you. This says school. Do you have any figures on administration for educational service districts in terms of percentage of administration? This bill does include educational service districts.
It uses the word school district, and I thought K to 12. I didn't think of the educational service districts because they are a unique educational entity.
And that I would believe it's important to keep them separate. The issues surrounding the two entities are very different.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess one of the things that I look at, and I think that this is going in the right direction, and getting more money into the classrooms is one of the goals that I have. It only talks about one piece of the whole budget, and you know we've got all these other support services, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't set any limits for any of the other pieces, just this one piece. Why is that?
I think the other piece you're talking about, Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, is the instructional staff budgets, which I mentioned earlier, are subject to collective bargaining, and I believe that you could find that that's 70% of your budget already. So, as I said, there's checks and balances over the remaining portions of the budget. There seems to be no checks and balances at the administrative level. In my experience, the way administrative salaries are held or determined are usually discussion between the superintendent or the president of the institution and the affected administrative person. So basically, it takes us out of the public light, so to speak, and does not provide for a bargaining process that's characteristic of other instructional staff.
My response to that, Representative Riley, is it's interesting being an administrator because you have no safety nets under you. We are administrators, and we know that any day of the week we can lose our job. And we have no union. We virtually have almost zero representation, and we are held accountable for our job at all times. And that's good, and that's bad. And in this instance, we know recently, whether it's Portland Public or Beaverton, and particularly Beaverton has lost several very excellent, outstanding administrators because, they can pay more in Texas. And so right now, we're being crippled by the fact that, Oregon finances are where we are, and this is just the limit where we can offer salaries for administrators. Administration is just, as Representative Ackerman has talked about, it is very different, but the concept of what should be spent on administration through research is very, very clear.
Follow-up. Representative Riley.
What you just said confused me, because the bill limits the amount we can spend on administration, and you were complaining because we lost people because we didn't pay them enough.
That's right, but
that's very confusing.
It's confusing, but it's the other part of the reality is, whether it's Beaverton, whether it's Ben Lapine, whether it's Ontario, it doesn't matter. This bill would create equity in Oregon. And the reality for me is, when the economic times are bad, it is going to hurt us. But we as a state need to recognize that, we have to put a cap on some of this spending somewhere. There are limits.
Representative Berger is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick clarification. Under this bill, a building principal would be administration or instructional?
Oh, we're always administration.
Okay. My question then, Mr. Chair, is basically for our staff. Steve? I too am unfamiliar with the New Zealand research model, and am curious.
Start doing your homework.
I'm sorry. I'm busy, Representative. I'm curious, your famous school runs. What do we have any way now of measuring on a district level what is spent on administration?
There are amounts for administration. Whether they exactly match what's in the bill is another question. And the detail that comes to the department versus the detail that the school district has. I'm sure it is available at the school district level. I'm not sure how much of that detail that would be needed for this bill is reported to the department
to capture. I guess I've got a concern in that regard, Representative, as well. When I read on Section 1, down on line 20 and 21, the support services mean services provided by personnel to support the instructional or administrative functions in the school district. Representative Ackerman, if I read that, that's OSEA. And you indicated a minute ago that the balance of it shouldn't be brought in here because they've got the collective bargaining to benefit them. Aren't these folks benefited by collective bargaining?
Yes, I backed that out though of the definition of administrative services, I believe.
Yeah. Oh, I see. That's backed out.
Only A is.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I see.
On line 7 to the end, administrative services do not include support services or instructional service or professional fees.
So this comes back to a pure administrative.
As pure as we can make it.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Right. Other questions? Representative Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I have more of an answer to Representative Berger. In this case, I'm going to echo what Representative Ackerman said. I've served on budget committees in three different school districts, and unless you understand the budgeting process, i.e. how to rip it apart, is very, very difficult to find out exactly where many of the administrative services are really spent. There seems to be an institutionalized, creative way, and I don't really think it's the school district's fault. It's necessarily the budgeting model.
Representative Berger.
And I would agree, Representative Boquist. I would also, and that's sort of why I asked the question first about is representing Quam consider herself administrator? Because a lot depends on how you define it. And it, when school districts, this comes back to uniformity in reporting, and how you, I don't disagree with this concept at all. It's getting there that I'm kind of asking sort of the questions, how you get there. Because you have to have a common set of definitions that absolutely nails this, and I don't, I'm not sure that in Oregon we're there yet, but I'd like working towards it.
Other questions? We do have some folks that are certified smart that are signed up on this bill. And so what we're going to do is thank you very much, and Representative Ackerman, thank you for coming in. We knew where Representative Comp was going to be during these couple of hours, but we appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
We're honored to have you here. And colleagues, we are on a temporary recess for House Bill 2964. I'm going to call a temporary recess on House Bill 3146. So we'll come back to that. And we're going to open then a public hearing on House Bill 2399. So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2399. Representative Lim.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think what this committee needs to do is we need to travel to New Zealand. Check this thing out firsthand.
That's additional administrative cost. Okay. All right. Thank you. Representative Lim, thank you very much for coming. We appreciate your patience. I beg your pardon for not being able to get to your request earlier. We did try to start on time. And you've honored us by coming here today, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Please proceed.
Chair Butler and members of the committee, and I want you to know I have enough patience. Only way I'm going and come back, going over there and come back, because I have another education committee meeting going on. So I tried to be there, and so I just got back. Thank you very much for hearing the bill, the House Bill 2399.
And Representative Lim, if you'd like, we can we'll just do this back to back on 2399, then we'll open a public hearing on 3445, so that you can. But if you'd like, go ahead on 2399 right now, and then
thank you.
We'll
I think that
on.
Will be a good time saving. For the record, my name is John Lim, state representative from Gresham area. It is my privilege that I'm here to testify on this House Bill 2399. I'm deeply concerned that our state continue to going into the our state becoming a mecca of gambling of the nation. Already our state, 25% more gambling in our state compared to any other state. It is when already the Oregon, that the Commission of Lottery, and that they approved for the slot machine line games, which will be coming sometime in July, in effect. And then governor also approved a pact with the Warm Spring Indian tribes to open in the state land one of the largest casino building in Cascade Lot area. This concerns me a great deal. Out of that concern, I have introduced House Bill 2399. This House Bill 2399 requires the governor to obtain approval of the Legislative Assembly prior to approving siting of Indian tribal gaming establishment on land acquired by Indian tribe after October 17, 1988. There are constitutional questions on the authority of the governor relating to approval of Indian tribal gaming. As you know, the Oregon Constitution, Article 15, Section 4, clearly states that our state prohibits casinos in our state. When Indian tribes come in our state land for gambling establishments such as called casino. This is alarming. It's about time we need to act. There has been some talk on lawsuit being filed for the governor's action, but I do not support this lawsuit. I believe the Legislative Assembly should handle the issue, not the court, at this time. In February 1999, U.S. Supreme Court made a critical decision regarding a court case in the state of New Mexico. The case said the governor cannot act alone in establishing Indian compact to permit gambling. A governor and his state legislature must act together for the Indian compact to be legal. Compact is a legal agreement or a treaty between state government and Indian tribe. In this case, compact permits gambling. In June 1993, New York's previous governor, Maria Cuomo, signed a compact with St. Regis Mohawk tribe that permit them to build and operate a casino on their property along the street Lawrence River. It did not permit them to have a slot machine. Considering U.S. Supreme Court decision earlier this year, it is believed that this compact is illegal because the governor did not involve the state legislature. In May 1999, Governor George Pataki amended the compact with the state with St. Regis Mohawk tribe and permitted slot machines in their casino. Governor Pataki did not sign this amendment to the compact. Deputy Counsel Judith Hard signed it, which brings up the question of legality of a deputy counsel signing an agreement on this magnitude. The New York State Racing and Wagering Board are being sued because the executive branch designated them to carry out the terms of the compact. Because of this reason, I'm urging the members of this committee that they pass this bill out to the floor if possible.
Thank you very much, Representative Lim. Representative Lim, if this law had been in effect prior to the governor's announcement last week, this law would have required the governor's action to have had 31 votes on the House for and 16 votes in the Senate. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Would you have anticipated that there would not have been 31 and 16 votes to support the governor?
I do not know. I don't believe that whether it's supporting or not supporting is not the issue. The main issue is that the governor has to consult with the legislators, and then if governor doesn't have a support of legislators, they shouldn't go ahead. If they support, it should. The point is not the supporting, not supporting. Point is the process. Because we are the representative of the people, and governor just cannot alone act signing the pact with the Warm Spring tribes, because that pact is in the land, the state land.
Let me ask this in a different way than Representative. You've been a senator, a state senator, and have been involved in the confirmation process. If this was similar to the U.S. confirmation of treaties issues, and you've referred to many other states and violations that have been noted in other states, and so if we fell back to a U.S. treaties approval arrangement, then it would have required approval by the state senate.
U.S. approval is a different matter. As long as it's confounded in the Indian tribe land, then it's between the governor and tribe, and then Interior Secretary is signing it. But that we elected officials who are sworn in to uphold the Constitution of the United States and Constitution of our state. Our Constitution clearly says that they prohibit casinos in our state. In that case, I believe, in my opinion, I believe governor exceeded his authority. And then, in these cases, our legislators, 9 legislators, should be involved in this process.
So relative to ceded lands, Representative, you, what of the ceded lands? Does this address the ceded lands, establishment of casino on ceded lands?
You mean scenic land?
Ceded. Ceded, previously owned and owned and granted to as part of the Indian Territory, and then eventually taken back by additional constitutional or executive orders, subsequent executive orders.
Well, I'm not sure exactly how to respond, but if it's the with the contract, with the pact and agreement given to us, to the state, then it's a state land. And that is clear, because we are acting with the contract, the federal government, state government, according to the contract. But especially Cascade Lock area is a state land. There's no question about it. And the one concern I have, when and the camel's nose in the tent, eventually whole body will come in. And then eventually that the other tribes, nine tribes already, they have their Indian casinos in their own compound. Eventually, out of a competition, they will be closing in to the Portland area. And you will see that the one is the beginning, and you will see the nine out there coming to the Portland area.
I guess I'm concerned relative to tribal lands versus non-tribal lands of those tribes or bands which were left without lands and were landless tribes following certain periods of time, and certainly we have that situation amongst the Cow Creek Band of the Umpquas and more recently the issue concerning the Klamath Nations where they've lost their lands and have been restored back in the 50s. So I am concerned about that, Representative. Questions of Representative Boquist and then Representative...
Well, I guess it's more kind of a question towards you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I understand what Representative Lim is presenting here and everything, and I believe it's Article 15, Section 4 he's referring to for our Constitution here in Oregon.
Yes, it's Article 15, Section 4.
Yes. The governor from doing what he's doing, I guess I'm just a little bit confused with what he's trying to do here and what it appears right now our governor's in violation of. The idea is, you know, it appears to me that the governor's in violation of what's going on with our Constitution.
And I understand there is a lawsuit, is that right? Did you say
Representative? Yes. Okay. Yes.
Well, I guess that's okay. That's where it'll be duked out. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm related to some, so I guess. Okay. Representative Boquist, thank you.
Well, first, Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm not related to any lawyers.
Okay.
I don't think they're allowed to talk. Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, I think I heard you say this, I'm sure. 25 U.S. Code 2719. Did you say that under the federal code, that cited federal code, that the federal law says that the governor has the authority, but he has to do it in consultation with the legislative body? Is that, did I understand you correctly?
No, that is not correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And I guess then there is a evidently a constitutional challenge, which is in the form of a lawsuit. And I'm sorry I don't stay on top of those things. I'm not sorry. I'm glad I don't stay on top of those things. But that probably will work itself through relative to the current decision made by the governor. But I'm anxious also of the sovereign nature of the American Indian tribes, particularly those nine federally recognized tribes in the state of Oregon. So,
Mr. Chair, I fully understand. As we and I recognize the sovereign nation of the American nine tribes in our state, I'm hoping that the American tribes recognize the sovereign state of Oregon. So when they come to our state land, and that it is our duty to protect what's happening in our state. That's the whole point. This is a constitutional issue also.
I appreciate that, and I still want to be sensitive to the fact that there have been landless tribes, created, and there have been, and they have to have some tribal lands returned to them. And I said, not rather than returned, they've been buying those lands back as they've gone along. So, by and large, by acquisition. So, I'm anxious that we strike a good accord here with our sovereign nations within the state of Oregon as well. Other questions, members of the committee, while we have Representative Lynn on this? Yes, Representative Boquist, further questions?
Mr. Chair, more of a question to you. But if we pursue this in the future, get staff to pull Chapter 25 of the U.S. Code, which is we're proposing to adopt to a U.S. Code that none of us are familiar to.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And, Maz, if you'll provide that to Representative Boquist, members of the committee. And what we'll do then is we will go ahead then and temporarily recess on 2399.
Mr. Chair, before you gabble out, one last remarks I'd like to add, because that area is a state-designated scenic area, and then I don't believe that gambling is mixed well with that, the Columbia Gorge scenic area.
Thank you very much. We'll then go ahead and temporarily recess on 2399 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2445. Representative Lim.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you very much for the hearing, House Bill 3445. House Bill 3445 states that certain organizations, likewise otherwise exempt from state tax, lose tax-exempt status if organizations knowingly contribute funds to terrorist organization. The purpose of House Bill 3445 is to prevent Oregon from subsidizing terrorist activities. There are other states, including New York, that the U.S. Department of Treasury taking similar steps already. The U.S. Department of Treasury has suspended tax-exempt status of three charities, because of their links to terrorist network. In a November 14 news release, Treasury said that the contribution to the three charities, Benevolence International Foundation, Global Relief Foundations, and Holy Land Foundation for Relief and Development, would no longer be deductible for federal tax purpose. This House Bill 3445 is sending a strong message to the terrorists. If they are going to have any activity, terror activity in our state, this is one of the messages. This is not the place for them to stay, act on it. Already federal government and FBI, according to my information, some of the terrorist activity going on in our state. This is alarming. And this is the land of opportunity. Anyone coming to this country, instead of take us, they should give to the community, to the state, to the country. This is the land of a dream. Anyone is willing to work hard for their opportunity, they can succeed. I'm hoping with House Bill 3445, I want to make our state more strong and safe and sound. Is that a good place to live without hampering quality of life? Out of that concern, I introduce House Bill 3445.
Thank you very much, Representative Lim. Representative Lim, I just have one question relative to that. There are folks from the Middle East who believe that Israel is a terrorist state. Can you help me with that perception relative to this, Bill?
Okay. I don't think it's wise to single out any nation, even Middle East or even Israel or any other countries. The bill simply states anyone and acting as a terrorism or terrorist action according to the definition of the federal government, and then a proclamation of the president and the UN, and anyone, any organizations that belong to those organizations, they shouldn't enjoy such a privileged tax exemption status like any others.
Okay. I think that it's the policy that once those organizations go on the 501c3 list or 501 hit list that they're removed from state to, would you, Elizabeth, would you bring us up to date on that, please?
Chairman Butler and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin-Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. So with House Bill 3445, you have already connected with a lot of the provisions that Representative Lim is talking about, and in your Military Family Tax Relief Act of 2003 with your Reconnect Bill, House Bill 2542. So basically, with the provisions in the Federal Military Tax Relief Act, those organizations that are on the terrorists, so to speak, hit list, they've been identified by the federal government, they are removed from any tax-exempt status. So they do not get that at the federal level or in Oregon with our connection with that law. Also, anyone who contributes to those organizations also would not get a charitable contribution deduction under current law and the connection with federal law. The thing that this bill, though, does is it eliminates tax exemption for those corporations that knowingly contribute to funds to those organizations on the quote-unquote hit list. So it does take it one step further than what appears to be under federal law, in the sense that federal law does not allow that charitable contribution to be upheld if it's going to one of these 501 charitable organizations
from
from an individual.
But
a corporation.
Takes it back one step, which says a charitable organization that makes a charitable contribution to a terrorist organization then would lose their charitable foundation
status.
That's
right. That's right. If they were an organization that was a nonprofit and got that charitable status.
So feeder, it'd be a kind of a feeder organization, yes, to a terrorist organization.
Yes. Now, just so everyone's clear, even at the federal level, the revenue kind of estimate nationwide from these provisions that were just, again, dealing with the contributions made to organizations that were on the terrorist list, as well as the organizations that were on the terrorist list and then would lose their exemption status, that had a negligible impact nationwide. So that's why I put this really as a no revenue impact, because it's going forward for beginning January 1st, 2005. I just don't think there's going to be many organizations that are going to knowingly, and that's the other issue, knowingly contribute funds to terrorist organizations that are already on the list. So that's why it has a no revenue impact for this bill.
Thank you very much for clarification.
Questions of Representative Lim or staff? Yes, Representative Boquist.
Just to follow up on my original question, Mr. Chair, to staff, and the same thing. We're talking about Chapters 8, Chapters 15, and I actually know a lot about Chapter 22 of the U.S. Code. And when you're connecting to something it isn't defined to us.
And Representative Boquist, I can give you a summary. Do you want of the Medical Family Relief Act? Because that's really in there is where we've really connected with a lot of these provisions that are dealing with the terrorist organizations. In there is really the act that we've recently had that has brought forward those issues.
Mr. Chair, that part I got is the Chapter 8, the Chapter 15, and Chapter 22. And again, I'm very familiar with Chapter 22 of the U.S. Code. If we go forward again, they've been cited in the law, and it would be due diligence for us to look at them.
Thank you, Representative Boquist. I think that's well taken. Part of that is the United Nations Participation Act of 1945, which is cited under U.S. Code, too. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions of staff? I think I would like to know what corporations, if any, have made 501 nonprofit corporations have knowingly made contributions to terrorist organizations.
Yeah, and Chairman Butler, we don't know that. I could try to see if I could get the list of terrorist organizations or something that the federal government has, but then to figure out which ones have knowingly contributed funds.
Pretty tough.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can I have a question?
Yes, Representative Galizia.
Yeah, I was just wondering, because I'm not familiar with who's on the list. And
well, you can't sign up.
Wow.
And this is
that's
not
brutal.
To sign up. This is not the list
I don't
to sign up to give the territory either.
No, but my question was this, because maybe Elizabeth knows who's on the list, but the former Secretary of Education referred to the National Education Association as terrorist-like activities, and I wonder if the NEA is on the list of terrorist organizations.
I have no idea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that. Thank you very much, Senator.
Okay, thank you very much. And then I just want to say a few words. This is reaffirmation and restating again that the and sending a strong message. This is not the place for the terrorist. And if you knowingly try to terrorize me because I'm going to pass this bill, that will be knowingly, you know, terrorizing.
We are all done.
Nine members of these nonprofit members here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate you taking your time. Your staff has been anxiously waiting for you there. I have no other people signed up on 3445. Therefore, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3445. We have completed one, and it's closed. We have three bills which are opened on temporary, or opened and closed on, or recessed temporarily, and we'll go back to those in the order in which they were published originally. And so we'll bring back staff on 2964, and then we'll follow up with 3146 and 2399. So we will come back in, and where we are on temporary recess, we'll reopen the hearing on House Bill 2964. And, no, the list is closed. Don't you remember I told Representative Galizia the list is no. Okay. Why don't we get staff? Why don't we get staff to go ahead and give us a staff summary on 2964, where we started off directly with Representatives Burley, Wisnant, and Crummell.
Mr. Chair, committee members, our House Bill 2964 deals with school taxes on exception value, and this is subject to voter approval. It would be submitted to the voters at the May 2006 primary election. It would dedicate the school operating taxes on new construction and other exception value to capital projects of schools for 2 years. It would take those school property taxes on exception value and reduce the school property tax formula dollars by that amount. Take those out of the school equalization formula because they would be for capital and not for operations. And then the original bill, too, dealt with urban renewal, and you've heard that those provisions would want to be taken out, so I won't deal with that. And it would first apply to tax year 2007-2008.
Okay. Thank you. Our chair has been called away, and so I...
You're taking over.
I'm taking over. Questions of Steve.
Yeah, this is a non-terrorist related question. Did I hear Representative Burley also say that the referral to the voters was to be deleted as well?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
That was my
correct
understanding,
okay,
too,
okay,
that the Section 13 was what he indicated.
Yes. Okay.
Was the proposal. Any other questions, staff? We have some folks who signed up to speak on this. I'll take them in order. Lori Wimmer Whalen and Kent Hunsicker, Chuck Bennett, question mark. Okay, and these folks. I'll get these two. Okay. We'll take you in the order I called you.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen of the Oregon Education Association, representing 43,000 members. And this is our fourth session opposing this bill. And you're getting my written testimony as we speak, but let me just hit the highlights for you. As we understand this, and I promise to be gentle with Mr. Chandler on this time, so, as we understand this bill, what it would do is in areas that are primarily experiencing higher growth, it would take for 2 years the increment of the growth and hold it outside the formula, which means, of course, that your state school fund compensates. And it basically spreads that money, if you will, across the state. And so what you end up with is a phenomenon of a reverse Robin Hood strategy, taking from the poorer, often more rural areas of the state, and giving to the more economically vibrant or richer areas of the state that are experiencing growth. With some exceptions, I'd point out, for example, that in resort communities, retirement communities, that kind of thing, you might get, for example, in Lincoln County, resorts that are growing and a lot more of that tax increment, but you have declining enrollment schools. So you end up deploying those dollars in a place different from what I think the authors intended. So we believe that it's not only mechanically inefficient, but also unfair in terms of how it moves money around. It also takes money, in effect, out of the operations side of the budget, makes it a categorical capital construction-only set of funds, and then locks it into that usage only. So it kind of militates against the local control theory. So we've had some concerns about it for all of those reasons. I go into a lot more detail in my written testimony. We believe that the better way to fund capital construction, and we do acknowledge that this isn't a real issue for some areas of the state, but there are also other specific financial issues that other school districts are coping with. Precipitous drops in enrollment or unanticipated drops in enrollment can also present financial management challenges. High levels or unexpected levels of ELL, English Language Learning, or other special needs students can present unique challenges. I remember a few years ago, the Gaston School District nearly went bankrupt because one family with medically needy students moved in who were very expensive to educate. So there are a number of special kinds of challenges. Rural schools often have those kinds of challenges. And so we have various different kinds of challenges all competing for a fix. And we're worried that fixing any one piece of it, it's kind of like a fabric with a loose thread. If you pull the thread, what happens to the fabric? There are impacts to the other districts that I think it's hard to figure out unless we've got some kind of way of running the numbers and taking a look at it. But we do believe that for the most part, you'll end up with this fluky situation of basically the reverse Robin Hood phenomenon as I described. And so with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions?
Ken? Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kent Hunsaker, Executive Director for the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. And my testimony is brief. I believe that as you look at this bill, there's two things that are accomplished by the bill. One is to move money from general operating revenue to capital construction. And it's not clear how much money that is, but if you looked at the districts involved, it was Redmond $1 million, Bend $2 million. And when you think about that across the state, I wouldn't doubt that it could approach $100 million across the state. If you wanted to look at Beaverton, Hillsborough, all the major growing areas in the state, that's close to the amount that we differ in terms of what school funding should be. And recognizing that there are some issues with needs of capital construction in this state, but the key to solving those needs is not to take the money from operating revenues. The second thing that I'd reinforce is that whenever we do things like this, we do create winners and losers, and it's unclear exactly who the winners and losers would be in this. You can speculate that it would be those that are fast growing, like some of the ones that have testified here, would be the winners. That the losers could be some of the areas that are not growing as much in assessed value or in kids and things like that, and that there would be shifts in money that way. I think that until you have a printout, if you're really serious about this, about really what those winners and losers would be. It'd be hard to make a decision about this, but I'm very concerned about the shift in money. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, Representative Bradley.
And even with the printout, excuse me, Madam Chair, even with the printout, you would only see who the winners and losers are now, and that can change next year or 5 years from now, so we really wouldn't know even then.
Further questions, comments? Thank you very much. I'd like to ask John Chandler and Scott Berry to put together up here, taken in whatever order you choose.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Homebuilders Association, here in support of House Bill 2964. I'll be brief as well. I just want to stress a couple points from my written testimony. The first one is, we brought this bill forward some time ago, I think four sessions, excuse me, out of a deep sense of frustration that fast-growing districts were having a hard time keeping up with the need for going out for bond measures and so forth. This, we think, is a solution that really does help in those fast-growing districts. Excuse me. Go ahead for a second.
Again, this is Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association, and John mentioned that we've had this bill before the legislature a few times before, and again, this is just out of a frustration that we see between the way the property taxes are shifted in schools versus the way they are dealt with at the local level. So when a new community adds capital projects or create new buildings, whether they're commercial, residential, or industrial, those property taxes are taken and they remain at the local city and county level for the $10 per thousand. That's the incremental increase off that property. Now, when it comes to schools, it's a different story. That $5 per thousand generated off of that new building is then sent down to Salem, basically, the capital process, where it then returns back to them at X number of dollars per student. And the frustration I think that we have with that is those growing areas that are getting all that growth from whether it's residential, commercial, or industrial are not able to then take that and put it back into the capital construction of schools. This bill, I think, addresses that to some extent and allows them to keep some of that money local for a short period of time before it then rolls back onto the operating and spend that money on capital projects. And capital projects, again, can include not just the building of a new school in a fast-growing area, but the repairing of a gym roof or a school roof in an area that's not growing, but, in fact, schools are becoming dilapidated. So.
If I may, I apologize for losing my throat there. I wanted to bring out some numbers that I didn't have ready for distribution, but in Washington County, just to give a little bit of the context you heard on the Deschutes County numbers, these are countywide, and I don't know how many school districts would be affected by this. I know at least Hillsboro, Beaverton, probably part of Portland. There's about $1.1 billion of exception value created in 04. At $5 a thousand, that works out to $5.9 million, almost $6 million a year, two-year cycle, $12 million a year. That would be captured by this bill. We believe that's money that, and I, when you did measure 47 and 50, when the legislature passed that, I sat in the back of this hearing room off and on and watched for three lines on page 38. That's the only thing I was paying attention to, was a little piece of that bill. So all the AMVs and DMVs and other Vs in that bill, I didn't pay any attention to. I do know that when it's done, like we said a minute ago, school districts are treated differently than other forms of local government. The school districts that are growing quickly are penalized. Cities aren't. Now, cities don't get enough money. I understand that. But at least they get to tax new development. School districts, the $5 or whatever it is after compression, goes across new development, goes into the black box, outspits per kid. We think this bill addresses that. And I also want to stress, and I think it's very important because some of the earlier testimony touched on this, if five houses are built out in Eastern Oregon in some school district, this bill would give them $5, five houses worth of property tax revenue they don't get today. And I think it does help with the equity argument that this, and I'm not the guy you want running school numbers, I believe it starts treating districts better than they are now. We think it's helpful. We commend it to you. We'd encourage your passage. Be glad to take any questions.
Questions on from Mr. Chandler. Scott, did you already
just a couple of follow-ups? So there are a couple of questions about how difficult this might be able to collect this at the local school district level. And I think our information, or at least what we've learned so far, is that collecting this through the counties and then dispersing it to school districts, the counties are not going to have a major problem collecting this money. That dispersement then to the local school districts may need to be worked on, but I don't think it's a difficulty at the county level grabbing that incremental increase in property values. The other piece was in terms of the way money is spent. Chair Butler, I think you had brought up the numbers from Redmond, where they were collecting $3.5 million roughly on average per year. And over 5 years, yes, that does equal quite a sum of money. However, I would like to point out that savings account is then available for them to spend on capital projects. If we're talking about that money theoretically going to operating costs, that $3 million is gone every single year.
I have a question, and while Scott already mentioned the theoretical portion, let's assume that you become a community like Ontario as a community that can't really build many more houses and doesn't have really much reason to be building homes when you can buy land. A lot is about $15,000 to $20,000 less for a lot across the river. And all things being equal,
we have other bills we'd like to talk about.
Yeah, okay, you're right.
Address that issue as well.
But let's say 100% of all of this 3% increment, or the increment over the 3%, was all commercial, and you don't have new kids coming in. I mean, Ontario's school district actually has been relatively static, with virtually tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars worth of building in the last many, many years while this has been ongoing. So I don't have any more students, and yet I've got this rather significant increment. Is it only on residential, or this was...
Chair Butler, the answer to your question is no. It picks up commercial, industrial. It picks it all up, and then that money would be available for any sort of capital project, including the repair of a roof of a dilapidated school.
So even where I've got declining student population, this could in effect generate big bucks for capital new schools, which we may not. Actually, what's been happening is they've been saying, well, we don't want this school, so we'll close it down, and then the other other charter or the what do we call it when the migrant and Indian coalition schools have been taking those schools over that the school district doesn't want anymore to take care of pre-K and those kinds of things. So I could have then in effect I could have a declining school population with a rather significant commercial activity ongoing. I'd build a factory in Ontario, and I'd love to see that. I'd build a factory in Ontario, I might get 5 homes, maybe 10 homes, but not 100 new homes if I had 1,000 new jobs. Out of 800 to 1,000 people working at the prison, we're now approaching, we've exceeded 2/3 of those in Idaho. In other words, their local folks didn't build new homes. They just moved into the vacant ones that we had. So I guess I'm looking at that and saying, if this accumulated $15 million for Ontario, and Ontario would like to have some new schools. Please don't misunderstand where I'm coming from. Ontario would like to have those new schools, but there's not new students. I thought that's kind of what this was supposed to be for, was for the Beavertons and the Sherwoods and the Bend La Pine, where we've got huge influx of students, and therefore we, or as Representative Hass indicated, you know, two new kids at every school every year or every day of the year. So my concern is, what of those folks that accumulate that money?
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me speak to that if I might. I can't obviously go to the Ontario example, but I'll use City of Portland, which has had a declining school enrollment while it's had rather significant growth, both in residential and commercial and industrial. City Portland School District has a great many buildings, though, that are in need of asbestos removal or rehabilitation of one sort or another, older buildings that need Cat 5 lines, other sorts of high-tech retrofits. This bill would allow for that. And I can't, obviously, I can't speak to Ontario, but I'd bet you a cookie that there are needs of that sort, even with a static or declining school enrollment, that could still be helped by this, where there currently is no resource for that available.
Okay, there's no question Ontario wants another school. And would like to have the resources, and has actually attempted at one point to pass a bond, and the people in Ontario just said you haven't made the case for it, and it went away. Matter of fact, they told us we could make money if we borrowed money, and I said, Jimmy, if we can make money, if we borrow that money and put it on a bond, why don't we borrow, why don't we bond $200 or $300 million as opposed to $50 million, and let's make some big money.
You got an email from some guy in Africa, didn't you, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, right.
Then, Mr. Chair, we might be able to develop some residential land.
Yeah,
right. Well, I'm just anxious that certainly if the issue is to assist in those high growth districts, and we've got low growth districts with some commercial activity, with not a lot of new families moving in, then what happens is that we're building buildings, and I'm also concerned about the issue of what message that sends if we've got $15 million sitting over here. And I take what Representative Burley said very carefully in mind, too, and that is, well, that could assist in servicing that debt so that you really wouldn't have to go back to your constituents at that point. And I don't know that that's a bad deal, to have to go back to your constituents and ask them to participate. I strongly believe in the right one person, one vote in that regard. Other questions? Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you both for coming forward. And Bruce Reeder signed up. And I see that. I'm sorry, Brian. I beg your pardon. Bruce Reeder is my scoutmaster back in the Oreida Scout Council, so he's not even in scout uniform. It must be Brian. Welcome, Brian Reeder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Reeder. I'm the Director of Policy Research and Analysis for the Department of Education. I want to be very brief today. I want to register the department's opposition to this bill. What this bill does is reach into the state school fund, pull out a bunch of money, and tell districts they have to use it to use it for capital purposes, at a time when the state is struggling to adequately fund its schools. The department thinks that's rather poor policy. Mr. Chandler indicated that if five houses get built in a district, that maybe that district ought to be able to keep the property tax money from those houses. And I would respond to that by saying, well, where does that money come from that district would be able to keep it? It doesn't come from the taxpayers, because nobody's taxes have been raised. Where it comes from is the state school fund. In effect, what it does is it reaches in, it reaches out to every other district in the state and takes a little bit of their money and says, I'm going to use that for capital. I think the key issue here is adequate funding of the operations of Oregon schools at a time when the state is unable, in my opinion, to provide either adequate or stable funding for its school system, to then convert some operating dollars into capital uses is extremely poor policy. And with that, I will end my testimony.
Mr. Chairman?
Thank you. Representative Hess, you're recognized.
Thank you. I respectfully think it's absurd for you to say that it reaches in and takes money that isn't there. There's this new construction that isn't there now. The money isn't there now. And if somebody builds a house in Beaverton, it has absolutely no effect on the school fund prior to that being built. It's not in there now. And when you say it goes into other school districts and takes money out of the school fund and imply that it's taking food out of the mouth of babes, I mean, that's just really a stretch.
Chair Butler, Representative Hass, I simply described to you how the state school fund process works. This bill would not create new houses. Those houses will be built whether this bill passes or not, and the property tax from those houses will flow into the formula as local revenue whether this bill passes or not. The passage of this bill will then take that money back out of the formula and will, in effect, reduce the amount of money that every school district gets through the formula. That is a fact. That is not my opinion.
Follow-up. Representative Zaff.
Well, when you use words like take it back out, it has never been there in the first place.
Chair Butler, Representative Haas, it will flow there.
It will, but it's not there. When you say it will take it out of existing funds, it will take it out from other districts, that's just a stretch.
Okay, well, let me rephrase that. Chair Butler, Representative Haas, it will prevent money from flowing into the formula that otherwise would flow into the formula if this bill does not pass.
Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Reeder. Further questions of the members of the committee?
Mr. Chair? We're lining up over here, Mr. Chair.
Representative Haas, so one final comment.
What is ODE's solution to the dilemmas faced by high-growth school districts and capital needs?
Chair Butler, Representative Haas, the Department of Education does not have a solution to that problem. We recognize that fast-growing districts have greater capital needs than other districts. The Oregon system for decades has relied on local bond levies to finance those. Rapidly growing districts, because rapid growth very often is accompanied by increases in property values, those districts relative to slower growing districts have greater ability to raise revenue. As the assessed value in a district grows, the tax rate on existing bonds declines. The tax rate required to fund an existing bond levy declines as assessed value grows. And so over time, fast-growing districts have increased ability in financial terms to fund additional bonds. Now, whether they can convince their voters to approve those is another question. And the department recognizes that these are important issues. We do not believe that converting what are currently operating dollars into capital dollars is a wise decision given the sort of what we consider fairly dramatic underfunding of school operations currently.
Thank you very much. With that, we appreciate Mr. Reeder being here. Thank you for participating today on behalf of the Department of Education. And with that, I've seen no further testimonies. Testimony for House Bill 2964. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2964 and move on to reopen the temporarily recessed hearing on House Bill 3146 first, didn't we?
Yes.
Okay. So we will reopen the temporarily closed or temporarily recessed 3146 and invite Chuck Bennett and Kent Hunsaker to come forward. And Steve, will you bring us back up to speed here, please?
House Bill 3146 deals with the administrative service costs of school districts, and it would limit those service costs to 7% of school revenue. And if those costs should exceed 7%, then it would reduce the district state school fund dollars by the amount of the excess and deposit those funds back into the state general fund. It defines administrative services. It would require a separate section of the budget listing those revenues and the staffing positions and the salaries of those positions that would come under the administrative services definition. It requires some documentation with those separate accounts. And it would allow residents to file enforcement petitions with the board to initiate any contested case hearings. And it would first apply to the 0607 year.
And colleagues, this is the bill upon which we've heard the excellent testimony of our representatives, a member of our committee, Representative Comp and Representative Ackerman. And we'll invite Chuck and Kent.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I've had a packet distributed to you. I hope will be helpful not only on this discussion, but perhaps as you decide if you'd like to cap other portions of school expenditures, it'll at least give you a feel for what it is, what this looks like.
Is there going to be a test on this later?
No, there will not be. This, although you may find it as you deal with other bills, it's helpful. It's a really good compendium of information. I'll take you through it real quickly. The top page labeled operating expenditures for administration and related functions gives you a look from 1999 audited school district expenses through 2003-2004, looking specifically at school administration, district administration, business services, and central support services, both the actual cost for the state as well as percentages. The problem with these numbers for you in terms of the bill is the rather unclear definition of administrative services. The numbers included here include all the support services associated. So you have a superintendent with a secretary, with office space, with a copier, and all the rest of it. That's all associated. As we look at administration, that's how we look at administration.
That's
as
the
an
first
aggregate.
Column, Jack?
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's the first column.
Okay.
And it'd be same throughout, Mr. Chairman. These all include those support service, and you can see down below in the kind of footnoted area the function codes. If you wanted to take a look at the book of accounts and kind of see what those functions look like. The second set of pages, I just thought kind of to give you a flavor of what you all are doing and the department as well as others in terms of relying on administrative services, I thought this might be helpful. The first one, it kind of has a whole series of references, is a list of just website reports required from a school district. These are ones that would be done on the web, and you can see just the variety of information being collected. The second stapled one is 118 other reports that are expected from school districts. Not all of them will be expected from every school district, but a large percentage of them will. And give you again a feeling for just what the administrative function looks like as required by you all as state government, as you're trying to keep a various account of what's going on in school districts. This third one is just to give you a feel. This is, unfortunately, this is 5 years old. This is the best data available at this point. And this is from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, just giving you a feel for kind of span of control, essentially administrator per employee, looking at different industries, kind of what's going on out there, how do we compare in school management with, and then this just gives you a list. We think we compare reasonably well in terms of span of control. Then we get to the colored pages, which will make it a little easier to keep track of. This kind of, and I think it's orange, salmony orange, 2002-2003 school expenditures. It looks at this as a pie chart to give you a feeling for how funds are being divided. And I think this is helpful just to get a look. Right now, 8.1% of school budgets in this 2002-2003 deals with administrative costs, and this again includes support staff, supplies, equipment, et cetera. So it's a gross figure, perhaps not as refined as the definition would be here, but it gives you at least a look at kind of what's going on out there, and I would submit to you that this hasn't changed dramatically in terms of basically the percentages out there. As you can see, we're generally spending about 60%, and then it goes through the remainder of the costs, operations and maintenance next, then transportation and food services next, and goes on down the list. And then finally, this one I just think is helpful for for any policymaker, and we've tried to make this available whenever we've been asked to come in on any issue that gives us a chance to look at this. This is the yellow, green, and gray pages.
Let me get your salmon check. Let me just go back to your salmon. This salmon is 2002-2003 school expenditures. So if I look for school building administration, 6.8%, that's the same as this first column on the white sheet, 6.83%. Is that right? And then I look for district administration, 1.3%. And that's the 1.3 here, 1.33.
That's correct.
Business services, 1.8, that's 1.85. And central support. I'm not familiar what all of those. What is central support? Is that bookkeeping, payroll, and audit? Is that what that is?
I really don't know the answer to it. I think that was provided by the department.
Okay. That's correct.
Okay, so I'm looking for central support here on your pie chart.
That would be general administration school board.
Actually, I think that's the part of the, Chair Butler. I think part of the problem here is that the white sheet was put together by the Department of Education, and the other chart was us going through all of their data and breaking things out in a different way. So they were put together at different times. You are very accurate that the first three are represented between the two charts the same, but I don't think you're going to find central services on the same in colored sheet in the same way.
But that
it's
wouldn't
just off a little.
So would it be in transfer? Would it be part of the food and part of the nurses and part of the technical?
I think what you'll find, Representative Butler, Chairman,
go ahead, Representative Kahn,
is that under school administration, you'll find a pretty close figure, the 6.8 to 6.58. And then when it says general administration school board.
Now let's see, this is just 2002-2003.
That's correct.
So if you look down at
I'm on the wrong year.
6.83.
Okay.
So that's 6.8. Compares up, and the 1.3 compares up to the 1.33, and then the 1.8 compares to the 1.85. I was just looking for the 2.4 in central support services.
And again, I think that I would say that is kind of spread throughout these other areas and is not categorized the same way. There's nothing that will match up with it on the same.
Is your understanding that the 7% represents portions of all of these, or all of first column, second column, and third column, and some of fourth, maybe?
Mr. Chairman, that's part of the problem. We're not exactly clear where this would apply. I mean, this reading the definition, Mr. Chairman, we're not sure if this applies down to department head in the English department because they have a certain administrative responsibility. There is a problem in the definition. I think it's determining precisely who if you're going to be talking about administration, we're talking about. And I think we're trying to look at administration from the perspective we think of as administration.
Okay.
And that's all we're trying to do is provide you with it. In that way, unfortunately, the bill just doesn't offer that kind of specific function code or some other way to do it. We just want to give you a feeling for what these numbers look like at this point.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry. I just wanted to make sure that I was
fair
comparing
question.
Apples now.
Finally, I just want to point to this final set that gives you a look again at the 0203 audited figures, which I don't think you'll find to be substantially different as time passes. Showing you a breakdown between instructional and support services, and we'll take you through a variety of categories, giving you a chance to look at your own school districts and what's going on in them in terms of percentages of spending. I would call your attention then to the gray sheets, which are support services. You were asked, I believe one of the members was asking about sort of what does it look like in my school district, and you'll find your school districts, and then on the front page, the final two columns, and then subsequently you'll find a breakdown of general administration and school administration by school district. Now, just give you a chance to look at it.
Let me see that I understand this correctly. Then I'm looking at this kind of yellow-colored copy, and it's indicating that in Portland School District, total support for instructional is 60% of total. 60%
support services in the Portland Public Schools is 40%. Okay, and instructional is 60.
Instructional is 60%. That means 60% is spent in the classroom on instruction.
On direct classroom expenses, that's correct. The remainder then is broken out among support services, whether it's transportation.
Including the portions which this bill addresses in administrative services.
That's right. And then I think, Mr. Chairman, if you go to these gray sheets, under support services, you can get a look district by district as to how that breaks out.
As to what portion of the support might be considered as administrative services.
Correct.
Under this bill.
Correct.
Okay. So, but I guess I'm kind of intrigued. I thought like 85% was going into the classroom. I don't see 85% of instructional in the classroom anywhere here, do I?
No, you don't. Mr. Chairman, 85% goes to personnel in school expenditures. That'd be the entire personnel area, including all employees.
Including all employees, including administration.
That's right.
Okay. All right. So how does this compare classroom-wise, 40% or 50, it looks like it runs uniformly between 50-something and low 60s. How does that compare nationwide? Is Oregon getting as much in the classroom? I guess this isn't where we do education. We're going to be talking about formula a time or two here, but
Chair, I'd be happy to try and answer that, Chair Butler. members of the committee, as you look at, and again, I'd look at the salmon sheet. Sometimes I think it's confusing because many of the services that are listed under support services, others would view as direct services. So, for example, media centers, counseling, nurses, speech, these are all direct services to kids in a variety of ways. They're not classroom teachers, but they are direct services. And I think that's part of the confusion is that people view many of those as all providing direct services to kids. And, of course, you know, it does cost to provide transportation. It does cost to keep the buildings in order and so on. And so as you look at these numbers, I think you're going to find similar kinds of results in other states.
Okay. Thank you. So then the backup for the support side of the yellow sheets is on the gray sheets then.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay, and these are all for 2002-2003 school year.
Right.
And then the green sheets, you told us what those were, and I'm sorry, I didn't...
Green sheets are instructional services.
Okay, and that's the breakout of the first total then.
That's right.
Okay, great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I could provide some additional points of view regarding this and the bill. First of all, one of the things that I would say about the bills is that it does take an area and establish a certain percentage. And it would seem that percentage would say that one size fits all, no matter the size district, no matter the circumstances. When you look at the gray sheets and the support services and go through administration, you'll find that one size doesn't fit all, that in many cases it's more expensive for very, very small systems to provide administration than it is larger systems. And I'll point out at the very top, if you want to look at general administration, for example, you'll see in larger districts that they spend quite a bit less on general administration. The lowest, and again, I'm on the gray sheet where it says support services 1. General administration is the third column over. And if you look at the top there, Portland School District is listed at 0.7%. That's well below the 1.3% that happens on average. The Salem-Keizer School District at 0.4% is one of the lowest in the state, period. I don't think I found another number lower than that in terms of general administration. And when you get to the really small districts, you can go look in that same column, and you're going to see 9s, 10s, 12s, 4s, all different kinds of numbers for them. And it's because if you're in a very small system and you have to have a superintendent, that by itself could be more. And by the way, that's one of the things that's required under the statutes is that every district has to have a superintendent. So, you know, the one size fits all in the thinking that 7% fits every district in the state just would not seem. The other issue that could be out there is it an appropriate policy to set spending on any area as we look at local communities dealing with their money and deciding how to spend that? It seems that this has come about as a result of some people feeling like we have too many administrators in the state, too many folks that are overseeing the system and not enough folks working in the classroom. I would go back to this data and say, as you look at that, you're currently spending, on average, about 7% on building administration in the state and about 1.3% on general administration and support services. That also includes their secretaries, all the equipment and supplies that would support that. And the DBI does not, you know, the database initiative does not match up with what the bill says. So you would have to totally redo the way districts keep track of administrative services in order to do this bill. And so I just question whether the setting of a percentage is, accomplishes what you want to have here. The last thing I would say is that, you know, that personally I don't like the word administration. I like the word leadership. And leadership is extremely important to school districts across the state. Most of you have experienced and worked with good leaders that really make a difference. There's research that says that leadership can account for as much as 20% of the achievement gain of students. That good leadership. If you look at the effective schools research, it'll tell you that the one thing that is the key to an effective school is a strong leader in that school. And those strong leaders are the kind of people that do what? They support the folks that really work in the classroom and foster their good work and so on. So, you know, we've all seen that. And I think any type of push to limit the type of leadership that we have in the state could hurt us. The other thing that I'm finding and I'm seeing more and more is that we have now a lack of folks that want to go into administration or leadership positions. We're seeing it at the superintendent level. We're seeing it at the high school principal level. We're seeing it at the middle school principal level. We're seeing it across the system. And you know, and things like this could even go, gosh, they don't even value that leadership at the state level and are saying you can only spend so much money on it. And so I think you have to be careful with that as a policy way to go.
So you're changing the name of your organization to COSL? Is that what you're saying? Okay. Questions of either Chuck Bennett or Ken Hunsaker? Yes, let's start with Representative Belizio.
Kind of just following up on what you just said, the perception, I would argue, at least in my district, is that there's a failure of leadership. And you're also saying that, pardon me, fewer people want to go into leadership or administrative positions. You have a perception that public schools are not doing the job that they should do. You have examples, perhaps anecdotal, of sort of these administrators who are getting very nice salaries and benefit packages. I mean, is it a failure of your organization to either do better public relations or to better do your job? I mean, where does the accountability lie? Or are Oregonians just, they just don't get it, or we just don't get it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Belizio, I mean, I could take any of your points and talk a lot about them. For example, that administrators are way overpaid. The data on that does not show that at all. In fact, on a daily basis, starting administrators make less than higher-paid teachers. And it's one of the reasons there's some difficulty attracting folks to that. We have that data. Be happy to share it with you. It's kind of a long story, each one of those things. I'm not sure what district you represent in terms of concerns about leadership. I'm just saying that that leadership is extremely important to all systems. You saw data here today that says if you want to compare the number of administrators in education to any other field, it's not even close. And that data is old, but I can tell you that right now we're looking at the data saying that our numbers are not 12.8 anymore. They're more like 1 to 20. And that's what's happened in that field. So, you know, I could take any one of your points, and I'd be happy to talk about those. And yes, maybe we do have something to do in terms of public relations. I'll even, you know, one of the things that came up here today and fits in the same category is these excessive cash balances that have recently come up. And folks pointing at leadership saying, what are those all about? And I can tell you that, I mean, I've prepared a statement on that we've put out. And what those are all about is because the way the legislature allocates money to schools in the last two bienniums, what do you think schools have to do? If you give them more money in the first year, a lot more money in the first year, then what do they have to do to operate in the second year? They have to save money, or they'd have to cut. And, you know, we looked at the Salem School District. That's $15 million difference between those 2 years. They got $15 million less in 2004-05 than they did in 2003-04. Is it appropriate for them to have $45 million in the bank? They had to have that in order to have the programs in 2004-05 that they did in 2003-04 without cutting. That was, in my mind, it was good leadership that planned for that. It wasn't excessive holding back of money that took away things from kids.
Thank you. Representative Boquist.
Just a technical question, Mr. Chair. I mean, Secretary of State's all over school audits. You just told us all these numbers were audited and all the data is audited. I'd like you to explain the auditing process and how these are all audited versus do we give more money to the Secretary of State?
Representative Butler, I mean, Chair Butler, Representative Boquist, audits are a requirement for all school districts in the state. Every district goes through a process of hiring an auditor that would conduct the audit. Those auditors are all registered folks that are qualified to do audits. And they use the required set of accounts to establish money in the various areas. So, all an audit is it shows that the various expenditures and revenues came in and went out in the areas that they were there. They do a variety of checks on the way money is spent. They'll go through purchase orders. I've been a superintendent for 25 years, so I've participated in a whole bunch of audits, and then they issue a report to the school district, and that report is then required to be sent into the state. And the state takes all of those audits, takes the expenditure areas, and they add up these numbers with them. So that's how they get there.
I don't think he was concerned about the mechanics of the audit as much as it was kind of a rhetorical question. Representative Boquist,
but the bottom line, yes or no, is it's a financial audit, an accounting financial audit, correct?
That is correct.
Thank you.
It's not a performance.
Right, that's exactly right. Representative Comp is recognized.
Just for the record, and I am administrator, and I have never done a job as hard as being a school principal. Other than being a classroom teacher was the hardest. And the reality is we may have 12.8 employees, but the average high school teacher sees anywhere between minimum 130 to 180 students per day.
The high school teacher.
High school teacher.
My principal saw me that many times.
Like I say, I'd be happy to only be able to take care of 12 employees.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here and having testified. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3146. We will come back now, and we had a temporary recess on House Bill 2399. We will reopen House Bill 2399 from that temporary recess. The last we had 2399 before us, Representative John Lim made testimony as to some articles in the U.S. Constitution, the Oregon Constitution. Maz, will you just bring us back up to date?
Mr. Chair, the members of the committee, the House Bill 2399, this is a very short house proposal for bringing the decisions for the compacts made by the governor to be done with the legislative assembly. And I think there was previously a proposal to go to New Zealand for a field trip. I think on this
we're not
one,
going to put that to a vote.
Monte Carlo will be a good one, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, right. Let's see. We'll have Susie Drewberry come forward. Susie, thank you very much for coming here today. And we appreciate your waiting until the last hour. You've been here since the first hour.
Chair Butler, representatives, thank you for having this opportunity to testify. I'm a longtime resident of Florence. Went to school there, went away to college, came back and taught. And as the casino has come to Florence, this is far more than an esoteric discussion for me about this bill. I am president of People Against a Casino Town Pact, and I am a plaintiff for the lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the Florence Casino Compact. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2399, which would give the legislature a role in the casino compacting process. This voice should have been here all along, and if it had been, and that by the voice I mean the voice in the compacting process, perhaps what happened in Florence would not have happened. The people in Florence, the community opposed it in town forums both in 1996 and in 2003. 80 to 90% of those who testified opposed the casino. We didn't have anybody to represent us to hear our concerns. The governor turned a deaf ear on our concerns, and it's a long story. The reservation and off-reservation casinos and how it happened in Florence against the community's will, and I won't get into all of that here. But because the casino was forced upon the community, we resorted to the lawsuit, which is based on the Oregon Constitution, which says the legislative assembly has no power to authorize and shall prohibit casinos from operation in the state of Oregon. The other part of our lawsuit is very closely linked to this House Bill 2399, saying that it is legislative authority. If there had been authority in the Constitution, that it's rather a legislative authority to approve the compact, not an executive branch authority. As Representative Lim mentioned, there are several other states where this has been challenged, different parts of the two different aspects of our lawsuit, and the precedents are on our side in, I don't know of a state where they are not. Wisconsin, New York, Michigan, New Mexico, Rhode Island, Kansas. I think I'm forgetting one. But that's most of them. This bill has implications. This bill and the future of casinos in Oregon have implications beyond the obvious Columbia River Gorge off-reservation casino siting by the governor. That in itself opened a Pandora's box of, as Representative Lim mentioned, competition for better casino sites. As you know, the Warm Springs did have a casino site, but it was not deemed to be lucrative. So the more populous areas in Oregon, Salem, Eugene, Springfield, and of course Portland, are looking, and Bend, Medford, are looking at the possible competition of casinos coming to those areas. Another aspect is, that I think that does need to be considered too, is how the casino was located in Florence, and there were some misrepresentations made where the community did not have input where normally they would, and there are some loopholes that are very that are still open for casino developers to work, and the BIA recognizes that, but they're, you know, they're advocates of tribes, and that's, they don't see their role in fixing those loopholes at this point. That's also true for that could happen in other communities besides what happened in Florence. In addition, there are six more tribes asking for recognition in the state of Oregon, and so there could be six more casinos. And there's no law that says one casino per tribe. It's just a policy which could change tomorrow. I'd like to conclude with a quote that basically summarizes why I'm here about casinos and why I oppose casinos, and I think it's a very well put quote. There are costs to families, communities, and ultimately the state when people go bankrupt playing games, commit crimes to gain money for gambling, get divorced, or fail to feed their children. There are costs when an employee does not show up for work because of an uncontrolled desire to play video poker. And there are costs to existing businesses when patrons divert their spending money toward gambling activities. That was a quote from the Governor's Task Force report on gambling. And that was by Governor Kulongoski when he was Attorney General. So it's kind of ironic because he understands. But anyway.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Are there other questions of Susie Dubray?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
Just two quick items. First, if you would, because you didn't at the beginning, could you state your name for the record?
Sorry, Susie Dubray.
Thank you. What I wanted to ask is about the Florence. Is that an off-site, off reservation? Not on reservation.
It was acquired after 1988, which is that's kind of been part of the discussion here. It was not reservation land, but under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, you have to have land taken into trust. And you have to state what your purpose for the land is. The tribes told the community that the purpose for that land was for cultural and historical purposes, and it was taken into trust. And then under a section of IGRA, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, they sought to get restored land status for that land so they could put a casino on it. Their first attempt at the BIA's, in requesting the BIA, was turned down because the BIA said, look, you wrote us a letter and said you weren't going to put a casino on this land. They appealed, and then Secretary Norton gave it restored land status.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Other questions for Ms. Dubray? Thank you very much, Susie. I appreciate your coming and offering your testimony.
Thank you.
Michael Mason. And Michael had previously submitted some testimony. Did you bring copies of that, Michael?
Chair Butler, members of the committee, I did not bring copies. I would be glad to provide some written testimony, but I don't have that prepared as testimony today, okay. Just as talking points.
Okay.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to address House Bill 2399 before the committee. I want to correct a couple of misapprehensions. Federal law already sharply limits the land that can go into trust for gaming, and we refer back to the Constitution. I should say Michael Mason for the record. Lobby for the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs. I've been in the practice of Indian law for 22 years, part of that time in the first Bush administration, and part of what I was required to do in that in the Department of the Interior was review all of the trust acquisitions, that is to say land being taken into trust by the United States for Indian tribes and individuals. So it is one of my areas of expertise. As I started to say, federal law sharply limits the land that can go into trust for gaming. We go back to the U.S. Constitution for this, the what's called the Indian Commerce Clause, in which at President Washington's behest, the Constitutional Convention agreed that this should be a strictly federal area, regulating commerce between the citizens and the Indian tribes. And he also at his behest, it was inserted in the Constitution that it was the United States that would have the treaty power. The United States would make the deals with tribes, and that's how things have been done with land going into trust. So this land has to be approved by the Secretary of the Interior, has to be concurred in by the governor, and he cannot concur, and the land cannot be taken in trust if he considers the acquisition of the land to be detrimental to the surrounding community. Talking about, you know, how unlikely it is for something like this to happen quickly or without a public process, the Cascade Lock Casino Compact was 8 years in the making. It didn't have a special state law, as we would have here. And without that, it generated a healthy public debate about the best site for a casino. It led to the rejection of three sites, one in Hood River proper, one trust land the tribe already had east of Hood River, and one other site in Cascade Locks for various reasons, a lot having to do with whether they were popular or not for this casino. So this public process channeled the casino to an underused industrial park in a struggling community that's very excited about its partnership with the Confederate Tribes of Warm Springs. The agreement is a fine example of the local control that our state supports in economic development. House Bill 2399 would override this control. The Warm Springs Agreement is also unique in that the tribes already had the right to gamble under federal law on a nearby parcel right near Hood River. They, under the compact, they surrender that right to gamble in perpetuity, and they give up the right to develop that land because it's in the heart of the scenic gorge. And instead, they chose a site, again, an industrial park within city limits, that's the development of which is consistent with the Gorge Scenic Act. Also, looking at the federal law, and I very much appreciated Representative Boquist's comment about having portions of 25 U.S. Code in front of you when you're talking about this, because you have to look at the details of the federal statute, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act here, when thinking about what the state's role should be. We believe that 2399 would conflict with the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act because it says specifically, it requires that the governor must concur. It doesn't say the state. It says the governor. And it's a situation of an executive branch function of the federal government, it's now in the president and the Secretary of Interior's hands, being shared with the executive in the state in question. So we believe that this bill would end up being struck down. Finally, I want to say that the highly complex compact process tied to this trust land issue is one of the reasons we have an executive branch of state government. This is a very difficult negotiation between sovereigns. It took a year. It's akin to treaty making, actually a lot more complex in its points. And the Attorney General and the Governor devoted much time to complete this agreement. The legislature, frankly, just doesn't operate on a schedule that allows for now renegotiating this deal, which is what would be the result of 2399. We see this bill as an attack on a long and carefully considered project that the local community, the tribes, their legislators, and the governor wholeheartedly support. We don't think it's worthy of our state. So I'd be very happy to answer questions.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure for the record, I had asked a number of the tribal nations and sovereigns wanted to be here today to weigh in. I asked Michael to go ahead and assist us in this regard, rather than fill up the room and the schedule with a large number of folks testifying on behalf of the nine sovereigns in the state. So thank you very much, Michael, for doing that. Representative Boquist is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to, I guess, understand your interpretation, Sheriff, through this is if 2399 was passed, that it would go back and have an impact on the, correct me if I'm wrong, the PAC that was already agreed to by the governor. You're thinking it would, or are you seeing this in the future? Because you made mention that it would go back and.
I think you said if it passed and if it were held to be constitutional. I think it was a constitutional problem you brought up earlier about it.
Yes, Chair Butler and Representative Boquist, I think you have a good question there about retroactivity,
right.
Retroactive effect. And I can't guarantee that this would have a retroactive effect. Obviously, that's a concern. That would be another issue for litigation. But I don't believe it would hold up in the first place.
Follow up, Representative Boquist.
Sure, I mean, I'd like to go back and expand and make sure I understand what you were saying in the PACT agreement, which I don't know. It's like knowing something about the United Nations portion of the U.S. Code. I don't know anything about this one. So I think what I heard you say is that under the PACT process, you had tribal lands, original tribal trust lands that could have been utilized in the vicinity of Hood River.
That's correct.
In which discussions with the governor as the chief executive, these discussions went on, and you, in for better word, traded those the opportunity to do something to those trust lands for whatever agreement you got, and it was with Cascade Lots. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Those will become ceded lands as well, then, or as those will cede back to the nation.
Actually, what will happen with the trust lands is they will remain in federal trust, but there will be a permanent conservation easement
right.
held by the state of Oregon.
On the existing trust lands.
Exactly.
So that they wouldn't be used for anything other than what they're presently being used for then.
Yeah, I think the only thing that could be used for it would have to be consistent with that Marco Hatfield Scenic Trail that runs adjacent to them, or runs actually through them. It would just have to be consistent with that recreational use.
Okay. Representative Boquist? Or Boquist? Berger?
Yeah, we're all getting tired. But Representative Boquist actually started down the road that I was going, which is the significance of the October 7th, 1988. And I would just like to to ask the question, not necessarily get it answered, as to the specific wording within this and its impact on all previous governors' PACs, because there's nothing other wordage in here about timing, and I guess I'm asking the question, if we go forward, is there retroactivity in this to this last, and what does it say about the Florence and all of the other, and that has never been brought out with regard to this specific language, and so I would submit that we need more information on that if we're going to go forward with this.
Thank you. Is it my understanding that the Cascade Locks land was ceded land, will return to be trust land at this point?
The site in the industrial park, yeah, will
return to
will
trust.
Go into trust land. Yeah, okay. Trust. And I appreciate, Mr. Chair, and the Confederate Tribes of Warm Springs appreciate your use of the term return, because there were 8 villages in the vicinity of what's now Cascade Locks. And the Indians of the Cascades, I cannot pronounce the term. It's a Wachlachl, something like that. But that particular tribe, I mean, they have always fished there. They've always utilized those lands, even though being pushed onto the reservation back in 1855. I wanted to add, too, I'd like to, for the record, I only have one copy of this, but we can get more contributions of Indian gaming to Oregon's economy. Prepared for the Oregon Tribal Gaming Alliance by Econ Northwest, I think helps counter some of the, you know, admittedly negative aspects of gaming. There are many, many positives related to the tribes.
We all got that in our office, by the way.
You got this already. You're good. Okay.
I think additional copies are available down in Indian Services down on the first floor. Representative Galizia.
I just had a quick question, Michael, because you talked about local control, but obviously this is a larger public policy question we're having in the state, sort of vis-a-vis gaming. And absent, to the extent a lawyer could say, absent the what the courts decide in terms of jurisdiction, wouldn't it make sense to have larger body of representatives involved in making decisions, because it arguably affects more than just the local area.
To go back to my point about this, there are very good reasons that we have an executive branch versus a legislative branch. I mean, this legislature has enacted many policy, policy statements, has enacted many statutes that are incorporated into the compact. And I would redirect you, just so that you know where it is. I know everybody's too busy to read anything now, but the entire compact is on our website at kaneta.com. So it's kaneeta.com. And it's well worth looking at the parts that you're interested in. But I think looking at the recitals helps explain, and there's several pages of those, helps explain why it doesn't work to negotiate this with 90 people. It needed to be negotiated with a small team of the governor's and attorney general's office. I mean, I that's why I see this bill as an attack. I don't think X of a deal can be negotiated with that large of a group. And there was considerable input, you know, as I say, from the representatives of Hood River County, elected representatives of Hood River County, of the reservation and others. So it's not like there's...
I guess, Michael, yeah. I would go back to my original question to Representative Lim in that regard, and that would be, does he believe that this, if 2399 were law at the time, that the governor wouldn't have 31 and 16? I personally believe he would, without... I believe there are that many representatives who would support the governor in making the decisions he makes. And he is the governor of the entire state of Oregon, too. He just doesn't represent Cascade Locks. That's a concern that I would have with anything retroactive on 2399. I think you're probably right that the problem has all sorts of red herrings in it to try and reopen, to use it as a reopener of anything that's happened in previous administrations would be very difficult. Other questions of Mr. Mason? Thank you, Michael, for coming and for representing the tribal nations and for your discussion here. We appreciate you taking your time.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Butler, and members of the committee for hearing me.
Thank you. With that, colleagues, there being no further items on my agenda, we've just about worn out the clock. So with that, we will close the hearing on House Bill 2399 and close revenue for today.